You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. I'm Tom Carruthers, Vice President for Studies here at the Carnegie Endowment. It's my pleasure to be the moderator for this session, in which we're going to be discussing Brian Levy's new book, Working with the Grain, Integrating Governance and Growth in Development Strategies. As we all know, in the early 1990s, the development field made a big advance, which was to start taking seriously the idea that governance is fundamental to development. When it initially did so, it did so with a rather simple framework, the basic idea that the patterns of governance that characterize established, wealthy, successful Western democracies are the kind of governance that we'd like to see in developing countries and believe will help facilitate, fuel, and sustain development. Ever since that initial framework was adopted, it got more complicated. Some countries have some of these characteristics and don't make progress in the way that people hoped. Some that don't have these characteristics do make progress. Some move in unexpected directions with a certain amount of these features and so forth. And so we've entered into a long and complicated discussion under the heading of, it's complicated. But it's complicated isn't good enough. It's not good enough for practitioners who need guidance. It's not good enough for publics who want to be convinced that we know what we're doing and spending taxpayer dollars wisely. There's a growing scholarly and practical literature trying to go from it's complicated to more in-depth and, I think, sophisticated ideas. And this book is a substantial contribution to that literature. It's a serious effort to come to terms with it's complicated and to move the ball forward. Brian Levy draws upon very extensive experience, first as a scholar in the early part of his career, but then many years, over 20 years at the World Bank, in positions working on especially Africa and Asia, but also significant management role in helping the bank's work on governance evolve in a broader way. And he draws on that to good effect in the book. And I can tell you, as somebody who's written a few books, Washington and other practitioner capitals are full of practitioners who tell me at the ends of conferences or seminars, I'm going to leave and write a book, and I'm going to put it all in there. Now, usually they want to write a book to pinpoint just how obtuse their colleagues are and how much smarter they were than their colleagues, but sometimes they have higher purposes as well. If I had a dollar for every one of those books I've heard about, I could retire. Very few of those books ever get written. Very, very few. I would say under 1% of those ambitions translate into books. A couple of years ago, Brian said, I'm going to leave the bank. Tom, I'm going to write a book. And I thought, 99% or 1%? Turns out it's 1%. A couple of years later, a significant book is in our hands. One final thing I want to say is that this debate has so often been beset by a problematic framework, which is, on the one hand, there's some people who really strongly believe that democratic norms and practices are good for development, and some other people who really have serious doubts about that or even have a penchant for believing that non-democratic practices and norms are good for development. Brian's not in either of those camps. He wants to lift the marble out of either of those holes that it tends to roll into and argue that it's complicated, but that there is some order behind the complication. Let me just read you one quote that gives you a sense of the tone. And some of the people in the room might feel themselves to be in one camp or the other, particularly the former, and may be struggling as you listen to Brian, thinking, wait a minute, is he about to tell me that dictatorship is a good thing? That makes me really nervous. That's actually not what he's about. And I would say, on a personal note, someone who grew up in South Africa would be an unlikely position to take. So have a bit of faith and listen to the complexity. Let me just read you this. While it takes a certain arrogance to write a book like this one, it is arrogance of an unusual type. It's not the arrogance of certainty in a fixed view, but rather the arrogance of determination to puncture fixed views. It's the arrogance of certainty that a fixed view, whatever it is, and the triumphalism that often accompanies it, is surely wrong. That's the guiding philosophy here, which I think is a useful one, even though we're 50 or 60 years into the development enterprise. After Brian speaks, we're going to hear from Larry Garber, another very thoughtful practitioner. Hasn't told me yet about a book he might be thinking of, but you never know. but somebody whose work spans 30 years of work on democracy, governance, rights, development, a tremendous range of experience here in Washington with USAID, with the National Democratic Institute. In the field as mission director in West Bank Gaza, a very substantial aid program in the late 1990s, in the private charitable world as well. And so Larry brings a tremendous amount of experience and perspective. And so I asked him to read the book in advance, think about it, and give us his thoughts. So he's going to do that, and then we'll turn to you. Brian.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And Tom, a special thank you to you, not just for this event, but actually, I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago, we had an event on development and democracy bringing them together. That inspired me to write a piece that was called The Case for Agnostics. And it was that piece that inspired me to write the book. So very fundamental. Big thank you to you. So as Tom mentioned, I am originally from South Africa. Coming from South Africa, I cannot but be an advocate for a democratic part of that. But having said that, I think we know that this is a very difficult time.
This is a very difficult time for those of us who advocate democratic paths of development. When we look around the challenges around us, challenges which are too many and too varied to even try to list, we know that we've overpromised. But because we're so deeply committed to our vision, we find it difficult to rethink. We find ourselves trapped in what I would describe as best practices rhetoric around this. And in this book, I try to lay out a practical alternative that goes beyond its complicated to that best practices rhetoric. I certainly don't claim to have all the answers. There are going to be gaps, but hopefully it's a start. And here's what I'm going to do. Do this talk in three parts. Going to talk first about the problem that we've dug out, the hole we've dug ourselves into through overpromising good governance. Then I'm going to speak about multiple pathways, the challenge not of where are we trying to get to, but how do we get from here to there. And then finally, I'm going to talk to ways forward specifically for the democratic path of development, noting clearly that it's not the only path, but that's the one to which I give more attention. So let me begin with something that is familiar to everybody in this room, and that's the motherhood and apple pie list, the different ways of writing this list of the good governance agenda. Make government accountable, strengthen the rule of law, support the right to information, reform the public sector, assure a level playing field. We recognize all of this. This is motherhood and apple pie. We think it's all terrific. But the trouble is that what we've done is we've been so hypnotized by our list that we haven't gotten to the point of asking, so how? What do you do first? What do you do later? How do you get from here to there? Is this an implausible or an implementable agenda? Now, in fact, this agenda is the agenda that underpins how many development agencies, I can speak best and most for the World Bank, tend to have gone about the challenge of trying to get development results. I'm not going to spend much time on this picture, but I want to basically give you its basic frame. The guiding idea, this comes from a 2004 World Development Report of the World Bank, and the guiding idea behind this is that the way you get results is through a chain of accountability, that citizens hold politicians accountable. That's in the left part, that politicians set the terms for policymakers, that policymakers, especially if you do it through the new public management, will write a compact in terms of accountability for results and performance, and then you will get development results. And if you aren't getting results, it's because there are weak links in the chain, so if you fix them all, you will get outcomes. This is what they call in this the long route of accountability. And the question arises again. Is this a plausible agenda for achieving results in the 5 to 10 year horizon, which is the horizon which most policymakers are going to be thinking about? And I would argue it's not. One more feature of this overpromising. So many of us have heard that mantra of the last 2 decades that good governance is necessary for development. And many of us, when we hear that mantra, it's accompanied by a graph. You can use all kinds of different measures, but it's accompanied by a graph that looks like this. And when this graph is ordinarily presented, what's pointed out is, well, look, if you're a high-income country, you've got good governance, and if you're a low-income country, you've got poor governance, therefore, good governance is necessary for development. That's a complete misreading of what that graph says. It's a misreading in a narrow sense, in the sense that its correlation is not causation, although I think that's less interesting. But it's a misreading in a more fundamental sense. It's a misreading because what we see when we look at that graph is that in broad terms, with a lot of variation from country to country, governance and per capita income co-evolve. They move together. They move together with leads and lags. Maybe sometimes governance leads, sometimes growth leads, but they interact with one another. And they interact with one another in complex ways. And that if you want to get development moving, the question is not, what does it look like when you get to the end, when you're high income? The question becomes one of, how do you get from here to there? And in a sense, this graph, which is so often used as the assertion that you see good governance is necessary for development, says nothing of the sort. What it says is there's a journey from here to there. And if we want to achieve development results, we need to understand how we can more effectively engage that journey. And that poses a problem for us. It poses a problem for us because where we now find ourselves is we now find ourselves, once we've gone down that step, we said, okay, so there's no best practice. It's no longer a matter of saying, this is the way it should be, let's retrofit good governance. Instead, the place you find yourself is, if you're Bill Easterly, well, we're all searchers groping in the dark, for those of you who know Easterly's work. Every country is unique, which implies there's not much opportunity for learning. And I think that puts us also in a deep, deep hole. So the question that we have to ask is, can we provide some structure to this problem of how you get from here to there? Can we provide some structure that is not, I mean, of course, there is structure in the best practice vision. The way you get from here to there is just do it. But if that's not the structure, and the structure is not every country is unique, is there some framework that we can use that can, in a sense, distinguish between a relatively parsimonious number of ideal types around which we can think about this? So when we ask that question, here to there beginning if you're more or less like this, or if you're more or less like that. And in some sense, that's the essence of what, and it's in a sense the core analytic frame that you find in this book. And it looks, now in that space of getting from here to there on multiple pathways, it looks something like this. And this framework, I mean, just quickly, what you'll notice is if you look at the bookends on the left side and the left side are countries that are trapped in endemic conflict. This book is not about countries in conflict. That is an extraordinarily difficult problem, and I've had the, I don't know, I could say luxury, I could say cowardice, not to have worked in those settings of countries that are trapped in endemic conflict. This book's not about the left side. Nor, ultimately, is it about the right side, because the right side, which I'll call sustainable democracy, is what it looks like in Frank Fukuyama's language when you've gotten to Denmark. Okay, when you've gotten to Denmark, you've got sustainable democracy. The question is, how do you get to Denmark? And so what this does is it draws on, in obviously a somewhat simplified way, it draws on two sets of kind of sustained intellectual work. The one set of sustained intellectual work is the work of Doug North's. And those of you that are familiar with North, I mean, there's early North, middle North, and late North. And this is actually late North. Okay, late North, in a sense, violence and social orders, in the shadow of violence, that with his collaborators, Barry Weingast and John Wallace, late North talks about the distinction between personalized and impersonal institutions. And late North argues that always and everywhere, the development process unfolds from in a setting of personalized institutions, and over time, in ways we'll talk a little bit about later, may over time, there's no teleology in the framework, evolve progressively towards more impersonal institutions in which all those who have standing are treated more or less the same. And so what we have is we have a distinction there between personalized and impersonal rules of the game. And this is what North's work has been looking at. How do they evolve one from the other? That's the horizontal axis. The vertical axis is the work of Mushtaq Khan and others. And this work is something that DFID have been sponsoring and working on a great deal. It's the work around political settlements. crudely, you could say it's democracy versus authoritarian, but there's a great deal of very, very rich work that Mushtaq Khan and others have been doing, which describes the dynamics of two very different kinds of political settlements. Political settlements which are the outcome of one set of factions wins and the other loses, versus political settlements which are in some sense a truce between competing factions. And if you take those two frames and you put them together, you end up with those four cells in the middle. And those four cells in the middle, I would argue, and I'm going to focus in particular on three of them, the four cells in the middle describe a series of very, very different points of departure, in each of which the opportunities and constraints are very different one from the other. And so once you start thinking systematically about each of them, and any given country is going to be some hybrid, but there's a useful point of departure, once you've located a country in each of those, you begin to see a different set of distinctive ways forward. So let's look at them. I'm going to talk through three. The first one is very simple, and I've put it up there, and that's basically old-fashioned modernization theory. Modernization theory, which says you have dominant leaders, some subset of dominant leaders, and that subset might be a relatively small subset, may turn out to be developmental. General Park, Paul Kagame, you might argue Meles Zenawi, they might turn out to be developmental, and out of that developmental start, you get growth, and that growth gradually produces a middle class, and that middle class eventually creates a critical mass, and what you end up with is democracy. And that, of course, is the story. I mean, if we were to do a poll in this room and we were to ask ourselves the question, viewed from the lens, from the vantage point of 2014, which country has been the most successful democratizer of the last half century? And I think I ask people this, if you thought about that and you pose it, your answer may well be, well, actually, as the lens of 2014, it's Korea. And how did Korea get there? Korea got there as Korea Inc. Korea got there in a setting of government powerfully in the driver's seat, in a relationship between the private sector in which, I teach at SAIS now, having left the World Bank. I just taught a Korean class today, and so I will resist the anecdotes of the way in which government directed and shaped Korean growth, but it did produce sustained inclusive growth over a quarter century, between 1962 and 1987. It produced a critical mass of a middle class. That middle class, I mean, what's fascinating about Korea is there's a long history in Korea of students coming out in springtime and demonstrating against government. And if you look at the 20th century, every now and then the middle class, others would join them and government will fall. And that's what happened in Korea in 1987, and we see competitive politics and a demonopolized economy. And that Korean story is basically, I'll come back to this again later too, it's a path to democratization that goes through the dominant trajectory. The second point of departure that I want to look at in the typology, and the second point of departure for those of us who are committed to democratic development, it's one I'm going to be spending a fair amount of time on, the second point of departure is, I think, a critical one. It's that setting where your political settlement involves a truce between competing factions. They agree that what they will do is they will decide who gets to govern on the basis of an election. Who's been watching Afghanistan over the past couple of weeks, but we'll put that aside. They'll decide who gets to govern on the basis of an election, but other than that, the rules of the game are personalized. It's a world in which there are only relatively small disparities in power between contending factions. There are few formal rules. The basis for stability is the discretionary conferral and withdrawal of favor, which North and others call rents, and others might call corruption. And time horizons are short. Nonetheless, you look at that, you say, my goodness, this looks like an unpropitious platform for development to happen. But it turns out that out of that platform, it can provide, Merrily Grindle's phrase, a good enough platform for economic dynamism to unfold. Take, for example, before I go there, there are about a dozen countries. I mean, in the book, there's a chapter which says, let's look at the 40 low and middle income countries that grew rapidly between 2000 and 2010, and it uses the worldwide governance indicators, let's try and locate them in this typology space. And there are about a dozen countries that you see that are rapid growers with this combination of personalized governance. But the poster child is Bangladesh. So Bangladesh, I'm sure many in the room are familiar with it, this is a country which has been built in two-party competition since 1991. Bangladesh turns out to have been the country that in 2001 and 2005 had the dubious distinction of being rated the most corrupt country on earth. And if you look at the data today, it rates today in the bottom, certainly the bottom quintile, bottom quarter, bottom quintiles. And the effort made in 2006, 2007 to implement far-reaching governance reforms, and it fails. So from a governance point of view, you look at this and say, oh my goodness, this is a tough and difficult environment. But look at the development outcomes that we see in Bangladesh over the same period. Bangladesh has consistently been growing since 1995, between 5 and 6%. If you update that data, it goes all the way to the current period. It's growing at 6% per annum. And gross primary enrollment, 72% to 98%. Under 5 mortality of children, down by 4/5. As of 1970, before the War of Independence, 235 out of every 1,000 children in Bangladesh would die before the age of 5. As of 2009, that number is down to 52. So we see in Bangladesh a powerful example that says that in this world of personalized competition, very, very, very far from our world of sustainable good governance democracy, you nonetheless can see powerful, powerful results. Now let me take briefly the third category. The third category is a category of countries which have impersonal rules of the game and which may be competitive, but in which, be it inequality, be it social tension, there are a set of underlying tensions in the society which would lead one to say one cannot comfortably conclude that this is a setting with sustainable democracy. And if you think, how do you get to that space? Well, one way you can get there that I'll talk to later might be an incremental evolutionary process. But the other way, the country I've just described for you, a country that fits that rather well, is South Africa, where the set of problems and challenges are not the same, contemporary South Africa, as countries that are still in a dominant environment. Nor are they the same of the world of personalized competition, but they're problems that are driven by a set of tensions and structural rigidities and structural inequalities that are unresolved. So, just to summarize this. When we talk about democratization and the path to democracy, there's the fantasy story, which is that we wake up one morning and we've got a sustainable democracy, or the first cousin of that fantasy. We wake up one morning, we call in the World Bank, we call in AID, we get a 5-year capacity development program, and then we've got a sustainable democracy. Or there are three dynamic pathways, just summarizing here. There's the dynamic pathway of the Korean pathway, dominance, which progressively produces more impersonal institutions, and over time a critical mass of transformation, I'll talk more about this, might lead to democratization. There's the version where dominance, the response to conflict and stress and strain is to democratize, but that democratization leaves unresolved deep-seated tensions in the society. South Africa, Thailand, just to pick a few. Or there's a version, which is the version which I'm going to spend much of the remainder of my time on. There's the version where the pathway to democratization is an incremental and cumulative pathway that begins in that the pathway to sustainable democracy is an incremental and cumulative pathway that begins in that personalized and competitive space. And so that brings me to the third part of what I want to speak to now, which are the ways forward for democratic developments. And I've organized this around three sets of themes. And again, as I said at the outset of this talk, I mean, Tom, I wrote a piece for you which was called The Case for Agnosticism, and the more I thought about this, that agnosticism is in the short to medium term. It's not an agnosticism of commitment. It's an agnosticism of trying to think through pathways. And so in that context, how, if one's commitment, if, for example, one's working in the Ghanas of this world or the Kenyas of this world, one's commitment is that development proceeds in those environments in a continuing open and democratic way, how might one think of the ways forward? So my first theme around this is going to be around islands of effectiveness. Just a reminder, why islands of effectiveness? A reminder of where I began. Where I began was to describe the characteristics of good governance, all of which are implicit in the vision that says that the way in which you get development outcomes is to invest in the compact or to invest in the voice, invest in voice. And that model basically, it underlies a technocratic view of how you do development policy or how you do governance reform, and it presupposes what I called here the well-functioning long route. It presupposes that those relationships of voice and compact work. It presupposes that technicians evaluate reforms, that leaders decide on the best options, and that bureaucracies implements. And that set of assumptions are exactly the assumptions that in that world of the bottom left quadrant that we're talking about do not hold. So what do you do? Here's one way to think about it. It's one way to think about these trajectories that brings us to the institutional side. The best practice assumptions presuppose that if we take the two axes in this figure, the quality of bureaucracy and the quality of checks and balances institutions, the best practices framework presuppose that actually they're both fine. And it's on that basis that you can proceed with policy making. The dominant trajectory, the Korea version, if you like, is one that says, let's worry about checks and balances later. Let's invest earlier in bureaucratic capability, use that as the platform for growth, and then this is the left-hand part of that figure, and maybe down the road, checks and balances institutions evolve. In the personalized competitive world, where in a sense what you've done is you've, your political settlement is a truce between relatively equally balanced powers, but no formal rules of the game, you find yourselves in the space. You find yourself in a space of, it's constrained. There might not be formal checks and balances, but that this is a constrained setting where power is checked. But power is checked with weak bureaucratic capability. So the question is, how do you move forward in that setting? One way to think about this problem is to say, in this kind of environment, in messy democracies, and I don't want to overdo the analogy because it doesn't fit so well, but maybe we live in a messy democracy because of the next sentence. In messy democracies, every level and every policy initiative is contested. And if you're going to ask yourself the question, what is the outcome of any given set of policy initiatives we're looking at, you want to ask yourself the question, how is a set of interactions amongst multiple stakeholders going to play out? You don't have a nice, tidy hierarchy between the line ministry that's responsible and the frontline service provider. You have multiple public actors that are all pressuring for performance. You have multiple stakeholders, some of whom are interested in trying to achieve a particular developmental outcome, and others are interested in capturing the resource that's available for predatory purposes. So at every level, you are in a strategic game that looks like that, and the outcome that you get is going to depend upon the relative weight and strength of the developmental coalition versus the predatory coalition. And the question you want to ask is there a reform coalition that can trump a blocking coalition? And when you tell a story about islands of effectiveness to people who do development work, they say, oh my God, this is messy, this is complicated, this surely can't be a platform for development policy and strategy because it means we're endlessly working at the micro level. Where can this get us to? So I'm going to tell you a story about a country. And this is a country which has these characteristics of democratic alternation. And it turns out that every single job at the central government level in that country is a patronage job. Okay, so you have the largest employer in that country, it was 40, 50,000 employees. You have leaders and rulers from one party in power, and the leader and his political allies appoint all 50,000 people. 4 years later, there's an election. everybody gets fired, and the other political party reappoints all 50,000 people. How many of you know what I've just described? How many of you are familiar with this work? That was the United States Post Office in the 1880s. That was the American spoils system in action. Now, there's a story. So we're talking about this pathway, and we're looking actually at the United States. This is the United States version of the narrative through this. There's a story that is sometimes told that what actually ended the spoils system was the assassination of President McKinley in 1882 and the passage of the Pendleton Act. But if you actually look, what you discover is that when the Pendleton Act was passed, it covered only 11% of federal employees. It took another 35 years before, and this is the Pendleton Act, by the way, those of you not familiar with it, it puts in place a meritocratic set of rules of the game and protections against arbitrary firing. It takes another 35 years before those rules cover two-thirds of employees. And in a rather remarkable book by Carpenter, Daniel Carpenter, The Origins of Bureaucratic Autonomy in the United States, he says, if you want to understand how this public sector evolved in the United States setting, what you need to do is you need to look at the narrative of public entrepreneurs in specific agencies. So he talks about Harvey Wiley, who I believe is the Truth in Advertising, Food and Drug Administration precursor. He talks about Clifford Pinchot. He just says that actually the pathway from more personalized to rule of law to sustainable democracy was a bottom-up pathway of incremental and cumulative gains through islands of effectiveness as much as it was a top-down pathway. So that's an historical example. Let me share with you four contemporary examples of islands of effectiveness in action in developing countries. So the first of them is not in the book, but looking at the current Ebola virus epidemic in West Africa, I thought it's one that's worth noting to include. I did some work in the mid-2000s, and I was looking at the effectiveness or otherwise of efforts to reform healthcare systems. And I asked some of my colleagues who were working in Africa, what are the big successes of transforming health systems in Africa? And their answer was, oh, well, that we know. It's Tanzania and Ghana. So then I went and took a look at what is the experience and the incidence of malaria before and after the decade of transforming healthcare systems in Tanzania and Ghana. Turns out that malaria was the single largest cause of death of children under five, single largest source of hospital admissions, even during the peak era of HIV. And it turns out that the consequence of 10 years of work on transforming healthcare systems was the incidence of malaria in both countries went up. If you look, there's a book that's done by CGD on Million Saved, I believe it's called. Million Saved is an example of a narrowly focused set of programs, especially around immunization, and offered targeted programs that do everything that people that believe in systems argue you shouldn't do, which is pick a particular focused area, it builds a constituency, it produces a result. It's an island of effectiveness that achieves gains. That's the first example I wanted to use, this issue of systems versus focused initiatives. The second one I wanted to focus on was transparency and participatory initiatives. And this is an area which, it's an area of very strange debate, because it's an area in which there's some romantic views that say if only you put transparency and participation in place, you can always get good results. And then it's an area which says, well, this never works. This doesn't work, it's just a romantic fantasy. Transparency can work and participation can work, but it only works through that long route focused around voice. A careful reading of the evidence, and I've got a whole series of examples there which I won't go through, but we can talk about them if you like. A careful of the reading of the evidence tells us something which isn't so surprising, which is that sometimes transparency and participation works, and other times it doesn't. If you ask the question, well, what's the transmission mechanism that's producing one set of outcomes rather than another? The answer that you get is that research is not well done. And frankly, just another pet peeve of mine, that there is such a preoccupation with randomized controlled trials that says, well, if you hold everything else constant to demonstrate an outcome, that you learn nothing about transmission mechanisms, which are the heart of that. So that's the second set of examples around islands of effectiveness. Third set of examples is around growth. Bangladesh has, by the usual doing business indicators type of criteria, a pretty rotten business environment. But Bangladesh, its growth has been driven centrally and first by a hugely thriving, rapidly growing garment sector. How did the garment sector grow? It grew not by reforming the business environment, but by focusing on targeted policies, special economic zones, bonded warehouses, duty drawback systems, targeted policies that enabled that sector to thrive when the broad-based environment did not thrive. And so when I visited Bangladesh, my puzzle was, because you spend time there, as everything is available for predation. So why did this industry take hold and not get predated upon? And the answer is really fascinating. The answer is that the critical mass of players that were in the industry cut across the two main political parties, and that they had a shared incentive to support and protect the reputation of Bangladesh as a place to source garment exports. So whoever was not allied with the group in political power could turn to their other manufacturers who were in order to get support to protect the industry. And then finally, an interesting theme, which I'm not going to spend time on now, but I think it's worth the reflection and discussion on, is the role of external anchors. If you're looking for means of getting commitment, if you can't build that critical mass domestically, what role can external anchors play? And it turns out when you look closely, they can play an important role, but there's a dilemma. Sometimes the enthusiasm for external anchors produces, if you were to ask people that work in natural resources today, what they would tell you is the extractive industries transparency initiative is a marvelous initiative, and the Chad Cameroon pipeline was a failure, for those of you that are familiar with that program. If you look at each of those two programs closely, what you see is interesting. What you see is that the Chad Cameroon pipeline is a story of a glass half full, of significant gains in a very messy environment with all kinds of weaknesses at the same time. The extractive industries transparency initiative, you can actually, if you were to write a corrupt contract, which basically said as its contract, we will commit to providing you with tax-free access to our natural resources, complete tax-free access to our natural resources, and obviously there's a side payment somewhere, and we will now monitor transparently how money flows, you in that world can be completely compliant with the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. So there's a puzzle here. Not a puzzle. There's something we have to look at. What's real and what feels good is a big, big issue on those. So that's a set of, as a way forward, we've spoken through the islands of effectiveness. So let me summarize where we've just been, and then I want to move relatively briefly into the remaining two areas around democratic development. What we have seen in these examples is narrow-focused initiatives can achieve gains in difficult, messy, and complex environments. So if it's public management reform, be selective. You want to think about, in a focused way, who the stakeholders are, not just in a romantic sense of let's have all the stakeholders sit around the table, but how do you build a trumping coalition capable of pushing back against predators? And often, in this kind of environment, you want to focus, as in the example that I used on immunizations versus health systems, you might want to focus on the targeting concrete results rather than processes. But that's static. That's the short-term view. What I now want to turn to is I want to take a longer-term view. That's the short and medium term. What does the longer-term agenda look like? The longer-term agenda, I see sitting here my former colleague Vikram Nehru, one of the economists, eminent economists at the World Bank, is a longer-term agenda is an agenda which I think economists can embrace. Because the longer-term agenda of moving towards sustainable democracy, the task is seek momentum, not perfection. Over the longer term, what you want to do is how can you kickstart and sustain a cumulative process, remember the earlier picture, of incremental gains on both governance and the growth and inclusive growth and the broad growth of the middle class. And that's done. The book, chapter 6 of the book, talks about a series of virtuous circles. This argument bears a resemblance to Acemoglu and Robinson, but unlike those, as you've already seen, it suggests that there are leads and lags and that there isn't one formula, which those of you familiar with the book know that it asserts. So let's take the Korean story and think about the Korean story through leads and lags over the long term. The Korean story, from the mid-60s into the mid-80s, is a story of inclusive growth in a dominant setting, which that inclusive growth provides a sense of possibility. So you've got mutual reinforcing positive expectations of growth and growth. Their institutions are improving, linked to the private sector some. What's not happening is political change. But what is happening is the building of a middle class. And so Korea from the 60s to the 80s is missing the link between positive expectations in society as a whole and the strengthening of broad-based political institutions. That kicks in after 1987. Let's look at the U.S. story, the U.S. progressive era. It's quite remarkable. If you look at the patterns of growth in the United States from the mid-1860s to the mid-1920s, with the exception of the 1905 financial crisis, that growth is consistently, in real terms, 4% per annum, inclusive. There's a boom, it kickstarts after the Civil War, there's a sense of optimism, there's a rising middle class. That rising middle class is described, when you read the literature in the progressive era, as an anxious middle class, because the country's urbanizing, society is changing, it sets in motion the social movements of the progressive era, another 20, 25, 30-year process of change, and that process reinforces itself through growth that plays out over 40 to 50 years. And so, to summarize that story, if you want to ask what are the economic underpinnings of institutions over the long term, you would ask the question, does a critical mass of society have an incentive to support and sustain impersonal rules of the game? Does a private sector have an incentive to support complex contracting and business environment which is open and creates opportunity, or does it want to play through political connectedness? Is the middle class interested in rights and opportunities or interested in patronage? How are you going to survive if you're in the bottom 40%? And I think in all of those you could argue that over the longer term, if one is looking to achieve the answer to that first question, complex contracting, rights and opportunities and a sense of hope, inclusive growth is a key part of the underpinning for sustainable democracy. So that's the second set of points that I wanted to make. And now my final theme. Yeah. This is the last point that I want to make, Tom. And this one was tough. I struggled with this. You'll notice what I called it. I called it here learning to live with uncertainty. I had called it earlier democracy's, what was the phrase that I used, irreducible promise. But I felt that I couldn't go with this because I think if we look at the world today, we know that this is a world of deep-seated uncertainty and deep-seated uncertainty in the space in which we operate. And so the question is, how do you learn to live with that uncertainty? And there's a relatively easy part to that answer, and there's a hard part to the answer. The easy part to the answer is to ask, if one is seeking to support democratic development, but one can only do a few things, what are the core minimum set of institutions that need to work in order to sustain competition? And I suggested there what three of them would be. But even with those, we know, and it's quite interesting, you look at countries like Zambia and elsewhere, governments seek to take on power. It's ultimately these institutions, alternation is only as strong as the commitment of its citizens to alternation. And that brings me to a very difficult point. If the trajectory that we're describing, this development trajectory, is a trajectory from personalized to impersonal, then the following is true. I initially wrote this as, you know, it's kind of had a nice positive ring to it, but it's a challenging quote. As long as inclusive growth is rapid, perhaps a seeming excess of order along the dominant trajectory, or seeming excess of chaos, think Bangladesh, may be less a signal that a country is off track than part of the medium-term nature of things. But think about that. In a world where a seeming excess of chaos feels as if it's on the edge of catastrophe, then an excess of order can be enormously seductive. And that's why I put that title of this part, this final part of the talk, how do we learn to live with uncertainty? And I've wrestled with this, and in wrestling with this, it deepens my own commitment. I mean, again, the South African context, this is real. It deepens my own sense of commitment to this, but not as an economist. Because if we ask the question, what is the irreducible promise of democracy in this world of uncertainty? What is it that, you know, in a sense, not yet, if the answer to why go through down the path of democratic development can't be, because that's the quickest and easiest route to a consumerist nirvana. Because that doesn't feel true. It feels like it might be a route, but there are also other routes, and they bring with them all their own different risks. If that's the case, then what is the promise? And I think it's this. I think it's something that's ultimately not economic. I think the promise is one which is an invitation to embark on a journey to shape our own lives and to participate through peaceful means in shaping our societies. And I think it's that, complete with setbacks and the gaps between the promise and the inevitably imperfect reality, it's this, not which somehow or other, in our preoccupation with the details of good governance, we've lost. But if ultimately we're serious about democratic development and our commitments to it are strong, I think they're deeply rooted there. Thank you.
Brian, thank you very much. Let's go directly on to Larry, and then we'll open it up. Larry?
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks, Tom, for organizing this panel, and I'm pleased to be here. I had the advantage of a couple of recent long flights to read Brian's important new book. I'm also pleased to see so many friends in the audience, including many of my USAID colleagues. One question I have is whether we can get others in our agencies beyond those in this audience to read the book, and I'll come back to this point at the end of my comments. Early in the book, Brian describes the evolution of donor engagement with public sector governance reform, and I think Tom referred to this also. He says, looking back to the late 1980s and early 1990s at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, democracy and human rights advocates who long viewed their cause as less as a mean to a development end than as an end in themselves, ultimately bought into the development agenda. I was one of those advocates Brian speaks of. I initially advocated that we adopt a purist view to our development work, investing only in the good performers, which were defined in both economic and political terms. During the past 25 years, I have evolved and have come to appreciate that development agencies must address the diverse challenges that we find across the globe. In doing so, we must often work in countries that are poor political performers, adapting our strategies, including reference to our own core values, to their circumstances. In this context, I note that we increasingly find ourselves working in the post-conflict or failed state environments that were in Brian's far left-hand column and that he largely excludes from his analysis, but which face many of the very specific issues that are dealt with in Brian's book, and I think we need to think about as practitioners how we apply those points in Brian's book to those circumstances. Let me start with a few words of praise for several of the approaches that Brian advocates in his book and that he highlighted here in his presentation. These include applying a 10-year planning horizon. My colleagues in Indonesia, with whom I was just visiting, made a similar plea that we go beyond what they viewed as a very short-term 5-year horizon and expand our frame of reference for achieving our goals. Utilizing a good fit as opposed to best practices approach. Recognizing that a zero-tolerance approach to corruption is both unrealistic and inconsistent with how investment choices are made in today's world. And last, presenting the idea of a public entrepreneur who can serve as the change agent for effective public sector management. I should note that this concept parallels the idea of a development entrepreneur, which has been recently featured in a couple of books published by the Asia Foundation and is touted as a tool for effecting difficult policy reforms. I also very much like the division Brian makes between dominant and competitive systems and the implication for those who are working to promote good governance reforms. However, typology inevitably simplifies the realities that we face. For example, we may see a dominant leader committed to improving public services. But how do we respond to the voices calling out for our support in pressing also for easing of restrictions on media, civil society, or political parties. So even as I have adopted a developmentalist orientation, I find it hard to remain completely agnostic in my attitude towards a confrontation between those practicing repression and those seeking to liberate themselves from repression. Having visited Afghanistan on my recent trip, the issue of electoral readiness that Brian also just mentioned is fresh on my mind. Many technicians, be they election administrators or experts in transition situations, will claim that countries like Afghanistan are not ready for Western-style elections. And yet the drumbeat for those elections come as much from advocates within the country as they do from external actors. Admittedly, those internal actors have very partisan political reasons for pushing their cause, but they play upon our general prejudices that political power should derive from credible election processes, and we find their requests for assistance hard to resist. My final point relates to Brian's plea for portraying development as an evolutionary process that requires flexible approaches as opposed to pre-specified blueprints. The question is whether donor agencies, including very specifically USAID, are ready to adopt this specific recommendation. There is a part of me that wants to answer the question with an emphatic yes. Like other donors, we have been talking about the importance of taking account of the political as we design and implement our programs. We have sought to develop tools for political economy analysis and tout the relevance of its application across all development sectors. Our introduction of systems thinking and our emphasis at looking at risk from multiple perspectives, including the risk of doing nothing, also form part of an agency mindset that welcomes innovation, iterative learning, and flexibility. And yet, even as we develop these concepts in our policy offices, and even as we encourage the field entrepreneur who is seeking to apply these approaches in implementing projects, the overall perception is that we continue to fall back on the planning paradigm. As Brian mentioned, the planning versus searcher dichotomy that Easterly presents in his book, The White Man's Burden. At USAID, for example, we pride ourselves at having reintroduced a strategic planning process, which includes five-year country strategies and evidence-based project designs. We now realize that we must consider how to adapt these approaches to the realities of working in a political, ever-changing world. Let me close by noting that in presenting his argument, Brian does not spend enough time in analyzing the incentives and pressures that make it difficult for organizations like the World Bank and like USAID to adopt the good fit mindset that he argues is critically important. That is, what is the political economy driving our institutions? And how can, other than reading Brian's book, we internalize these critical points about overcoming the existing bureaucratic constraints? Perhaps this can be the subject of Brian's next book, or as Tom has now encouraged me, maybe mine.
Thank you, Larry. Brian, let me start with one question, then I want to turn it over to you guys. I'll ask you to reflect a bit on the personal side. There's a point in the book in which you have a kind of mea culpa in the book when you talk about the late 1990s at the World Bank and the initial embrace in the sense of what you call governance maximalism, of the sort of conventional agenda about governance. And you look back on, I think it's the 1997 World Development Report about the role of the state, and where it says that the state, in a sense, you know, is crucial or drives development, and you disassociate yourself in a sense, kind of youthful folly. And this book is, in a sense, the trajectory of your own thinking.
How much of this do you feel the trajectory that you've gone on in trying to move away from what you view as a kind of straitjacket to learning to live with uncertainty, and good fit rather than best practice, complex typologies? Is that a trajectory that the bank is on, and therefore this grows out of, in a sense, the world you were part of at the bank? Or is this book a statement of frustration that you wish they had been on and you didn't feel they're getting there and they needed somebody else to step out and write this and help them get it? In other words, do you feel that there's significant movement in this direction, or are you feels that there wasn't enough and that, in a sense, impelled you to write this, hoping that you move away? Or I guess a simpler way to put it, how strong is that continuing conventional mindset?
So, I left the World Bank 2 years ago. There's been a new president of the World Bank who came in actually probably about a month after I left. I am not going to speak to anything of that's played out in the World Bank in the last 2 years. So there are two World Banks. And I suspect they're two USA. There's the World Bank. I want to read something because I have not written a Billy Easterly style. You know, the book, you know, explores the independent theory and action in many conversations over many, many cups of coffee with many colleagues, and I want to acknowledge collectively the colleagues with whom I worked at the World Bank for 4 centuries. Contrary to the usual stereotypes, the large majority of empty work each day dedicated to trying to make the world a better place and open-eyed about the complexities and ambiguities of the challenge. Now, that's the World Bank. And the World Bank and staff, and I suspect the same thing is true of the USAID, over time, is a different place with a different understanding of the world as of 2012 than it was in 1997. In 1997, I believe there was
a sense of hubris amongst many of us. Although, if you go look at that 97 World Development Report, you'll find that good fit features in it, but I'll put that qualifier aside. In 97, there was a sense of hubris. By 2012, over a cup of coffee, what I'm describing here was broadly understood, I would say, not by many, not by all, but by a significant majority of my colleagues. The problem is what happens in meetings. You know, and in what happens...
That's
in
water rather than coffee, I guess.
Yeah.
tepid water.
Yeah, I mean, aside from the bureaucratic politics of what happens in meetings. What happens in meetings, it has been fear. It's fear to say that certain kings have no clothes. Now, the question, I mean, in some sense, maybe this is part of why I write this book and why I actually did. I mean, there are many reasons one leaves an organization after 23 years, but one of the reasons was a sense of wanting to push the agenda from the outside, because in some sense, you know, you can't admire the king's suits when everybody knows that there are no clothes and everybody who's standing in the galleries is saying the king has no clothes. And so the question that I would take back, and I would take it back to all of us, you know, is can we, I do actually, chapter 11 of the book does speak to this dilemma, but can we in public space actually speak about the reality of imperfection that everybody knows to be true today? And I think we're moving towards a world where perhaps we can. You know, and so the World Bank over coffee has changed a lot in 15 years. The World Bank in meetings, what does it take for the discourse in meetings to become, quote, safe to speak truthfully about problems? I'm interested to hear Larry on that one too.
I think that's the challenge we face. I mean, so probably 90% of the people in this room will buy into everything, maybe 100%, because they're here, will buy into everything that you've said and that we're talking about in, you know, certainly over coffee, but even in meetings. But getting the rest of our institutions not only to buy into it in a coffee setting, but to actually apply it in the real world setting is the challenge. And I find it, you know, this is, you know, what drives me crazy in a sense is you can get people who will agree. I mean, even at the top level of the organization, who will say, yeah, I read Brian's book. I agree with everything that he says. And then go and, you know, implement programs that don't necessarily reflect the message that you're delivering here. And we need to understand why that is. I mean, I don't think it's bad faith. I don't think it's bad faith. But I think there are real incentive issues and other cultural constraints that make it difficult for us to apply the messages here and the approaches that you're advocating in the real world of the institutions we deal with. So to me, that's a challenge that we need to think about. And, maybe some of the folks in the audience have some suggestions both of why and how we can overcome them.
Thanks, sir. Let's have some questions or comments that can push Brian on certain aspects of his analysis that you'd like clarity about, agree, disagree. You can talk about that broader issue, whatever comes to your mind. I ask you to identify yourself. Because we're doing a video, we ask you to wait till the microphone comes to you, but they're not far away. So let me just take some questions and comments. Yeah, we'll start with Lynn Hammergren there, and I'll come to you.
I'm curious.
The microphone on your left, Lynn.
Brian, I'm curious that you focus on democracy because the World Bank doesn't. But do you think that they don't? I mean, the bank can't look at types of government. But do you think that the fact that they can't constrains them as much when dealing with autocratic leaders? I remember once walking into a meeting about Kazakhstan and saying after about 30 minutes, stupid me, but isn't it a dictatorship? And everyone said, that doesn't matter. But I mean, is it as constraining? It's certainly for AID, this is a constraint, because AID is democracy is one of the goals. But for the bank, it isn't. So do you think it is as constrained by your typology?
I mean, in a simple sense, Brian, you had on the far right sustainable democracy. That wouldn't appear in a bank.
No.
So you have a different goal in mind. And there, of course, there is a debate in the development community about whether democracy is part of the core conception of development or not. So you've moved to a place where it is. Let me take one more. And then this gentleman here, right on your right, there's a microphone. Introduce yourself.
Yeah, Mark Koenig from USAID. I was encouraged by your recommendation of kind of an opportunistic or flexible selection of islands of effectiveness. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think that's often been attempted by a variety of donors. But it does have a lot of pitfalls, as you began to identify. And so the question I would ask is, once a island of effectiveness has been identified and developed, what steps can be taken to avoid predation? Because mm-hmm. quite often it happens that you achieve real progress in a particular sector and higher authority comes in or corrupt elements come in and take it over. Or it could be sort of an internal degradation of the achievement, perhaps by personnel turnover or other forces, let's say an economic turndown, that make the island of effectiveness non-sustainable. So any comments you have on how to make this strategy more effective would be appreciated.
Why don't you go ahead with those two, then we'll take
some. I'm going to also pick up a little bit further in our earlier conversation. So, Lynn, I want to pick up on your one. Does the discourse on no democracy constrain at the World Bank? And I chose to frame this presentation around the challenges of democratic development in part because I'm speaking to this particular audience. There's a piece that's going to come out, there's a short piece on the book, and in the discussion on democratic development, its subtitle is The Virtues of Modesty. And the reason that I want to flag that is Bill Easterly was quoted a couple of days ago at talking about how appalling it is that aid agencies like the World Bank and USAID provide support to Ethiopia. Now, I'm old enough to remember when You had all the rock concerts on the starving children and the starving babies in Ethiopia. And if you look at the history of Ethiopia, if you look at the history of infrastructure in Ethiopia, by any sub-Saharan African measures, as of 1974, it was an astoundingly poor performer. If you look at basic education, it was catastrophic. If you look at human development, it was catastrophic. Just to give you some data. The death rate of children under five in Ethiopia fell from 204 deaths per 1,000 births in 1990 to 68 per 1,000 births in 2012. The enrollment, gross primary school enrollment in Ethiopia rose from 32% in 1990 to 96% in 2011, without, unlike other settings, the teacher-pupil ratio rising. So I look at data like that, and also if I look at the history of a country like Ethiopia, where, in a sense, if you ask the question, why is it that a country could have been as desperately poor as Ethiopia had been for as long as it had been? The answer is endemic conflict. So if you have a period in a country which has been a long-standing period of catastrophe and actually achieves this kind of turnaround, I think we want to think twice before we take the position that says this isn't good enough. You need to also change your political institutions because the two are linked. But I just want to flag that around this theme, there is in this book does talk about good fit. And so I think that that's an important, that's my first comment. My second comment is on, so how do we handle the discourse that is so poisonous where, you know, I mean, in my class at SAIS some years ago, I had a colonel from the U.S. Army on leave who was about to go into rural Afghanistan where he was going to command a regiment of troops. And he had been told by his superiors that there's zero tolerance on corruption, but the only way in which you can engage in rural Ethiopia was around shaping deals. You know, but yet, in our discourse, can't talk about these things. So my response to this is, oddly enough, my response is one that, and Larry, I'd be interested in your take because you come from such a different place, is to actually put on the guise, I won't say disguise, but the guise of being a hard-nosed development economist interested in a very focused and specific set of poverty reduction results. And quite narrowly defined, so that the conversation isn't about what are these institutions like and are they good enough? The conversation is about, so what's operating here that's preventing certain kinds of results from being achieved and how might we engage differently? Now, I think that the answer to that third, that question of how do we engage differently is going to take us into thinking about transparency, participation, and the nature of the coalitions that we put together. And I think the answer to the question that was posed about islands of effectiveness and predation and capture, it's another complex answer. So there's a book that was written, well, and I won't reference the book, but there was a book that was written, I will reference it, some of you will recognize it, called Does Participation Work? And this book basically concludes that it doesn't. And it concludes that it doesn't because it notices that programs that are targeted towards poor people have some leakage to elites. It doesn't say that program, in its conclusion, is not that programs that are targeted to poor people, all the resources are captured by elites. It says there's some leakage to elites. In the U.S., we know that how do you actually have, what are the entitlement programs that thrive? The entitlement programs that thrive are the inclusive ones. And I think the answer to this question around islands of effectiveness and capture is to think long and hard about the coalitions. Because in this book, Does Participation Work? Even though it's uncomfortable, well, in others that are there, you find lines that say, oh, well, it turns out that this was supposedly an inclusive bottom-up participatory process, but actually elites in the locality played a fairly central role. But interestingly, the benefits are fairly broad-based. And so I think part of what we want to do, because predation is the puzzle, is we want to think much harder and much less, dare I say, sentimentally about visions of design and the coalitions that surround effective outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to take some more. Okay, go ahead.
I just wanted to react to the point about Ethiopia because I think that's relevant. So, you know, I probably 25 years ago would have said absolutely we shouldn't be working in Ethiopia given the concerns. I mean, today, I accept, you know, Brian's argument that it is important for us to be addressing the development challenges there and that the government is taking some important steps on specific issues that you know, we are concerned about related to poverty and other issues. That said, and I think this is where some of the difference lies, is that we do need to keep in mind the democratic objectives. And Brian's piece on Korea, I think, is interesting because you don't know when is that crossover time period. You know, when is it 1987 in Korea? And particularly as an external actor, you need to be thinking about what is it that we can do to help push it in that direction, one, but also how can we know when is the right time to make those investments. The other point that I raise, and it's a difficult one, is how do we respond to the people in Ethiopia who are advocating that now is the time? You know, we may not think it's the right time by our objective technical assessments, but what about the people there who are making the point that now is the right time? How do we respond to them as development professionals? I just put it out there as a question, but it's one that we engage with in many ways inside the USAID.
Got a lot of hands suddenly. I don't know what you said, Larry, but yes, and then we'll come to both of you.
Hi, Andrew Wilson from the Center for International Private Enterprise. And speaking more from the perspective as a democracy promotion organization that works through economic reform and private sector development, I just wanted to sort of reinforce your observation of the importance of coalition. But I wanted to add that in our experience, it is possible to actually help support the development of coalitions of interest groups that want to promote development, even in authoritarian states. We've had tremendous success in working in very close societies, working with broad-based coalitions of weak groups that may not be able on their own to find voice, but through a process of just getting people to sit around a table and to learn to overcome their own it's often personality-driven, their own personal agendas, to work on common issues and to identify common economic development issues and business issues. That over time, their ability to show up as a coalition, as a united voice, and to promote constructive private sector growth policies often does find a receptive voice in government. Because government, whether it's authoritarian, I think, or democratic, does need to deliver at a certain point. And if it's not delivering, it does feel those constraints, and we've seen that in authoritarian regimes that fail to govern well. And that's where we've seen openings. And that, in turn, creates a virtuous cycle, I think, of both growth and the development of democratic institutions within the country, or the institutions that could help support democracy.
Could you pass the microphone to the person on your left? Yeah, please.
Hi, thanks. I'm Nicole Golden. I'm a consultant. I'm a senior associate with CSIS and a former colleague of Larry's at USAID. I'm interested, you talk a lot about inclusivity, and if in the book or just in your work you unpack that at all in terms of the importance of paying closer attention to demographics when we talk about inclusivity, whether that's rural-urban, whether that's demographics by age. In the Korea example you mentioned, one element is part of the Korean success is, of course, the demographics as well, the leveraging of the large youth population at the time towards economic growth. So when thinking about sustainable democracy and the importance of inclusivity, I think there needs to be some unpacking of who exactly we're being inclusive of or need to be inclusive of. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a couple more. Yes, right here. This one here, and then here, and I'll come to you.
Hi, I'm April Harding from the World Bank, although not speaking for the World Bank in any way. Okay. And I work on
this is coffee, not water.
Right, definitely. So this is I work primarily in the health sector, including a lot of governance issues. So I'm you know, trying to take a lot of what Brian's saying and sort of fitting it into my own experiences. And so that's the sort of foundation for my observations. One question or comment or ask you to elaborate on is this idea, this concept of islands of effectiveness. Because the health sector is a place where this, you even brought examples of you know, that certain initiatives can be done at, that could be potentially islands of effectiveness. You use the case of immunization as opposed to trying to develop the entire health system. And I wanted to get you to tease it out a bit more because I know that it's often the case that immunization programs, for example, are done in a very enclave way where outsiders mostly are sort of funded to do these mass campaign jab every kid between, you know, the age of 6 months and 5 years. And that, to me, does not sound at all like a platform, you know, an island of effectiveness as a platform for developing, you know, a health system that can serve the population. In fact, you know, in certain instances, for example, mass campaign distribution of bed nets could be the opposite. It could, in fact, it does occasionally reduce the country's capacity to assure continuous access and use of bed nets. So I just wanted you to sort of tease out a little bit further this idea of islands of effectiveness so that we could, you know, distinguish between islands that are really enclaves that really aren't helping and islands that are platforms for mm-hmm. for building something a little bit further. Then just on this this issue of coalitions.
Briefly,
this issue of coalitions, I just wondered if you'd thought about the implications of the fact, as I understand it, the World Bank is committing to focus on sort of one of the goals of the helping the very poor, the bottom two quintiles. And now, if you take that to its logical conclusion, it might be the case that it would make it harder to support the kinds of things that would attract and be a platform for building a coalition to support.
We are going to finish at 5:30. We've got a little bit more time. I'm going to take two more and then give Brian some less. So this gentleman, and then you've had your hand up also. Yeah. Sorry, let me see if we can fit you in. Yeah, thanks. Yep, this gentleman right here.
Hi, Kyle Rurick. I'm an IIE Democracy Fellow at USAID. I really like your typology, but the framing of your typology is definitely focused on the nation states, definitely focused in an object construction in a way that empowers the practitioner. Mm-hmm. Your example of Korea, and if we think about Peter Evans' classic book on Korean development, we know that fits well in your typology in terms of he focuses on what he called disciplining capital. But he also really focuses on sort of Marxist traditions of economic development and really looks at how both regulation and the world system in particular empower Korea, and specifically their economic advantage related to the United States is such a key piece of that development. Thinking about your typology, I just would like to hear a little bit of your thoughts about the role that beyond the macro state, the high macro policy, regulatory, and economic environment really empowers those countries to make it along your trajectory. So what role does that external piece have to success? Because both in the U.S. case and in the Korean case, those were key pieces to the recipe. And I just would like to hear a little bit. And if you were going to control for that, What would be your country you would look at that hasn't gotten a lot of those big advantages but still has a lot of these internal pieces that really fit well in your typology?
We're descending back into it's complicated, which is okay because it is. But I don't want you to leave the room today without a central message because Brian's trying to cover it. I'm actually, with your permission, time is short. I want to give Brian a chance and Larry a chance. You can come up and catch Brian afterwards. And in case I forget, special book launch price. $20. It's outside the door. Normally $35. It's a good deal. So you're welcome to buy the book afterwards. Brian.
Phew. So
on the issue of world systems first. I mean, I just ducked that issue in the book. I said I'm focusing on this at the level of the country. Now, yes, I'll just leave it at that. We could have a conversation on the role of the U.S., direct and indirect, on Korea, but I'm going to put that one aside. Here's a central message, and then I will try to link this, well, actually before the central message. I want to pick up again on what Larry said about Ethiopia. And I'm going to, this is a hard thing, but it's interesting to me how DFID have been fairly ruthless in saying we work in country A and not in country B. And when I look across the developing world right now, and I look at those countries that I will call the messy democracies, it seems to me that, well, there are the countries that are the failed autocracies, and there are that small number of countries like Ethiopia, which are the autocracies that are generating inclusive development. It seems to me that for us to be spending, and I'm speaking now, I mean, I have this weird double life because of my history, but I'm speaking now as an American. For us to be spending an enormous fraction of our energy berating Ethiopia for being insufficiently democratic, when the countries that are messy democracies are struggling, is questionable. I mean, it seems to me that we live in a world now, and I think it's part of what I take out of my own thinking in this, frankly. And I tried to frame today, and I frame the book, and I frame my own thinking around the space of saying, look, my commitment is towards democratic development. I prefer to work in those types of settings, but it is really hard. And I think we're understanding today much more than we did 20 years ago how it's hard and why it's hard. And so, frankly, as someone committed to democratic pathways of development, it seems to me that we want to prioritize those countries succeeding. So that's one comment. My other comment, which is perhaps a unifying comment, and it's a unifying comment that will address both the inclusion issue and the health issue around enclaves and islands, and it's this, that if we want to ask ourselves, so what are we achieving with what we're doing? I actually, Larry, don't think of 10 years as the long-term horizon. I'm using 10 years in contrast to Acemoglu and Robinson or the North Wallace Weingarten's 50-100-year vision. I think of the 5-10-year horizon as the horizon of practitioner and of practice. And I think the test that we might want to ask ourselves is what we're doing going to create the possibility of a somewhat better outcome 5 or 10 years from now? That becomes, I think, an implication to which we can test everything, how we define what we're achieving. So if I see compelling data on bed nets and targeted immunization programs transforming the lives of young children and making a difference over their lifetimes because of the effect, I would say that's a good thing. Yeah, it's true. It's an enclave. But does that mean it's not a development result? Do we want to compromise and sacrifice that development result? I'd say not. And I think, well, similarly, we want to be tough-minded. The question on inclusion. I've been wrestling with this question in the South African context. I've been doing some work on inequality in South Africa recently, and the data on inequality in South Africa continue to be astonishing. But what I find most concerning in South Africa today in terms of the consequences of this inequality is, oddly enough, not the bottom 40% and the most marginalized. South Africa's increased the average per capita income in the bottom 40% by 50% in the last 2 decades. It's still much lower than other middle-income countries. I think the catastrophe of non-inclusion is the catastrophe of, putting it crudely, but I'm not using the analysis that this might resonate with, it's the catastrophe that the median voter and the median citizen is actually continues to be profoundly excluded from the benefits of the society. So if you ask me what is a focus of inclusion, I would ask, on the margin, where is the margin where there are outsiders that aren't making it in, who could make it in on the margin? It's a different question from where are the most marginalized or otherwise excluded, because I think if we focus on that margin, we have the possibility of having an impact, which is both a real gain in the short term and potentially is more transformative and stabilizing and transformative in a positive way of that political economy over time. So that's my short answer. Think incrementally about incremental gains that are possible in 5 to 10 year horizons. But even as you do that, ask, what is the gain that can make a difference in the longer term? And both of these examples are incremental examples, but actually their long-run consequences are large. So make it better is what I would, in a 5-10 year horizon. That would be the thrust of the message.
Just a quick word on the island of effectiveness enclave issue, which I appreciate, but I also worry about in the context of external actors. It's very easy for us to focus on those islands of effectiveness and put resources into them and, claim them as successes, but not necessarily sustainable successes. And I think, again, I'm sure Brian would agree that we're really interested in the sustainable successes. But again, the way we operate, our own internal incentive structures, often allow us to focus on the island of effectiveness to just achieve, and I think the health examples are the best examples of that. There's been incredible successes, in particular health fields in many countries over the past decade. But whether those are going to be sustainable still remains to be seen. So that's the only word of caution I would put with respect to that point.
Brian, writing a book is hard work. And when it comes out, you realize you're only some small percentage of the way there, because then taking the book forward and getting it heard and getting it sort of, in a sense, into the bloodstream of the practitioner community is a lot of work too. But you've started on that process. We're glad to have been part of that. And we wish you luck in doing that. Larry, thank you for your comments. We appreciate that. And thanks to all of you. We'll see you again.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah.